like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and before we proceed, I want to thank Bev Capshaw and Ronnie Elliott for hosting the show last week in my absence, and doing a spectacular job. They played a fabulous array of animal songs, including two crocodile tunes. Great, great stuff. As for today, my guest is Erin Greenwood, a journalist who specializes in writing about animals. And in that capacity, she's the former animal welfare editor of the Huffington Post, and now contributes critter coverage to the Washington Post, the Today Show website, and the Dodo, among others. Greenwood is also an author whose new novel, Your Robot Dog Will Die, came out yesterday. Even before its release, the book racked up rave reviews and kudos. Count me among those enthusiastic endorsers, and really, the book practically seems written for listeners of this show. If you care about animal welfare and about a number of the issues we routinely explore in this program, chances are you'll embrace the book the way I did. We'll hear about various aspects of Your Robot Dog Will Die and choices Erin made along the way to writing it. Did I mention it's set in Florida and slightly in the future? When I speak with Erin Greenwood in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak with Amber Simpson about the 8th annual Tampa Vegan Bake Sale taking place this Saturday, April 21st at Mojo Books and Records. Lastly, on this show, guided by the expertise of Don Goldstein, we focused extensively on the constitutional amendment that could end greyhound racing in Florida that I wanted to deliver an important update about just now. The proposal, previously known as 67, but now known as Proposal 6012, has made it onto the ballot in November. So that's enormously exciting, but only truly meaningful if we all go out in November and vote yes. I'll be doing a big show on this closer to Election Day. Right now, let's get to Erin and her book, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885, and noting that this interview is streaming on Facebook Live via my personal page, that is Duncan Strauss on Facebook page. This is Erin Greenwood back on Talking Animals. Good morning, Erin.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great.
A little closer to the mic, or bring the mic closer to you, just so we don't strain to hear you.
And, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, better.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
A little closer would be good. So congratulations on the book. It only came out yesterday, as I've noted, but to you, it might feel like an eternity waiting for this day, or yesterday in particular.
Oh, God, so long.
Well, right? Isn't it like the run-up and the anticipation? Because you've had books in your hand, you've been able to give some to people in advance, but it's like, the big day was actually yesterday.
Yeah, it feels so good that it's finally happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sort of an impatient person, and I'm used to working in the online media world where you write a piece and 2 hours later,
It's up. Yeah.
And this is years in the making.
So it must be a whole different sort of rhythm and discipline and whatever. As I noted in the introduction, I mean, so much of this book feels like it could have been written expressly for the listeners of the show. I mean, that statement is a bit nuts, of course, on the face of it, because it wasn't. But so much of Your Robot Dog Will Die, from the overarching narrative to characters, major and minor, deal with a multitude of animal welfare issues and a surrogate of sorts for at least one high-profile organization. So all of which, of course, we do discuss on the show fairly frequently. So I want to delve into many of those areas in a moment. But first, I'd love to ask just for your summary of the book.
Sure. So Your Robot Dog Will Die takes place in the near future. It's set at a dog sanctuary for the last dogs on Earth. There's been near extinction of dogs due to a genetic experiment gone wrong. But there's a small handful of dogs, a half dozen real dogs who are left in the world, and they live at this sanctuary in Florida. And there's a small community of people there who take care of these dogs. Their whole purpose is to live there and make sure that these dogs are safe. And then our main character, a 17-year-old girl named Nano Miller, she discovers a dark secret about this place where she's grown up, Dog Island, which to her is just paradise. It's home. It's everything she loved. And she discovers something that puts her home at risk, that puts the dogs at risk, that puts her new love with her friend Wolf at risk, her family, and she has to leave Dog Island for the first time and try to save everyone.
Yeah, that's a very good synopsis, and who better to deliver that than you? But so I guess we should note that Dog Island isn't just in Florida, but it's kind of modeled very closely on
Gulfport, Florida.
Right.
Yeah, where I lived when I started writing the book.
Yeah, and you since moved to St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
Right. So you know the territory well, and very steeped in those details. So again, it has a Florida element to it, and obviously all these other animal and animal welfare elements to it. Now, before we get into some more specifics of the book, I'd like you to take a moment to explain what YA means and what about this book makes it YA.
Sure. YA is young adult literature, so it's basically for people who are ages 14.
A little closer to the mic.
Oh, sure.
Sorry. There you go.
For
Thanks.
People
you
who
might
are
just
ages...
want to bring it closer so you don't have to, I don't have to hassle you the whole time.
Can you tell that I'm usually behind a computer? And...
That's right. Yeah, I know. It's unfamiliar territory. But we just want to be sure
muscle.
To hear you loud and clear. That's the thing. So.
Right. So young adult literature is for people who are teenagers, but it's also for people who are adults, too. A lot of adults read young adult literature. And I didn't write this trying to change it in any way than if I would have written it for an adult audience. It happens to feature a 17-year-old main character, and her closest friends are also about that age. And, you know, some of the themes that it deals with are the things that you actually go through when you're that age, which I remember very clearly, which is discovering that your parents are fallible, discovering that the world is complicated, you know, having to grow up and make decisions for yourself and not just go along with what you've been taught. And I think those themes are big in this book. I mean, it's definitely partly a coming of age story. And I guess that's what makes it young adult literature. But I hope that it's good for kids and also good for older people.
Yeah, I think it really is. I think it really functions in the way you just described. It hits the kind of criteria for young adult thing. But I frankly, in reading the book, kind of forgot that it was supposed to be YA, which I guess is sort of a good thing, because to me it's just a really great story, really well told, and yeah, there are teenagers, including Nano in particular, at the center of it, or center of much of it, but otherwise it didn't strike me as like, well, this is, I'm just happen to be reading a YA novel. It's like I'm reading a novel.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah.
That's what I intended.
Okay, good. So so when the book was in its kind of fledgling stage, what story did you initially want to tell? I mean, what was the very beginnings of this in your imagination?
Well, it's a combination of things. This is my third book now, so I've come to realize a little bit about what the process is like for me. But now I'm just starting to learn now, three books in. But usually there's some sense of a setting that I'm interested in spending time in. I mean, that's a big thing for me, is that there's a world that I want to live in for the year, 2 years or 5 years, however long it's going to take to write the book.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it was a dog sanctuary in Florida. I just wanted to live in my head, probably in real life too, at some point at a dog sanctuary. And so I decided to set a book there. And then there were characters that I wanted to explore. And in this case, it was a girl who's coming of age, who has two best friends, and she has to sort of navigate growing up with these two best friends. And then also there were animal welfare issues that I really wanted to write about and get into. And I thought fiction was the best way to do it. And some of it is, you know, the tensions in the animal welfare world, the animal rights world, between different ideologies. And then also just the animal rescuers who I've spent the last 6-7 years writing about, and who I just admire the hell out of and wanted to pay tribute to in a book.
So within that, was there, as you sort of started to get those two or three main things forming a little bit, were there one or two themes that, okay, I kind of then, if I'm going to do those three elements, I want to sort of build the narrative around?
You know, a lot of times as I'm writing, I suppose more organized writers probably have outlines in mind and know where stories are going to go. For me, I often don't know what's going to happen in a story until my fingers start writing it out. So in this case, you know, I had a place where I wanted to start, and actually the beginning of it changed in the original book proposal. The first scene was Nano was supposed to be giving a tour of Dog Island, but she was too busy in the making out with her boyfriend in the supply closet. And then a robot dog had to come collect her. And that transformed. That changed. That scene ended up getting cut out, although there are plenty of kissing scenes. Don't worry.
Sure, you bet. Yeah.
But yeah, what was going to happen in it, as I've now found with all three of these books, actually, you set up these characters, you have them doing things, and then you come to realize the next thing that has to happen. And sometimes it's you know, you wish that it didn't have to happen that way. I mean, one of my follies as a writer, and probably also as a consumer of culture, is that I wish that bad things never had to happen to characters that I care about. So, you know, sort of in my ideal version of this, people would be living at a dog sanctuary and they'd just be really happy because, of course, they are. They're at a dog sanctuary in Florida. But that's not how fiction works. So
right.
You have to put them in peril.
Sure.
You have to have stakes.
It sounds like even though it wasn't highly plotted or structured on paper before you began, that you just sort of find your way and inspiration. Sometimes the people that write like that say, it just tells me kind of what's going to happen next. And then I follow that inspiration on the keyboard or whatever. But still, were there, even as you were unfolding in that direction, were there kind of themes or stories that you were mindful of telling, even if you weren't sure exactly the specifics of how the telling would go?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the central tension, which is set up very early, is that, you know, Dog Island is this community where there are only a few dogs left, but how do they keep the population so low? I mean, it's through a combination of hormonal birth control and also euthanasia. And the leader of Dog Island thinks that euthanasia is the kindest choice for many of these dogs. And there's a group of people who disagree with her. And then there's sort of a battle between those two groups. And you'll have to read it to find out what happens.
Sure.
But I think people who love dogs will feel very satisfied.
Right. No, there's a lot of dogs, both organic and robotic, and later other critters as well. Okay, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Aaron Greenwood, an animal welfare journalist whose work you may have read in the Washington Post, the Today Show website, the Dodo, and elsewhere. Her new novel, Your Robot Dog Will Die, came out yesterday. If you'd like to ask Aaron a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Also, we're streaming this interview on Facebook Live versus my personal page. So just look for Duncan Strauss if you're anywhere near a computer or Facebook, and you'll see Aaron and I chatting it up here in the studio at WMNF. So we have spoken a few times on this show about PETA, chiefly about the fairly horrific statistics of their animal shelter in terms of adoptions, and especially the staggeringly high euthanasia rate. And we've also discussed PETA's particular bias against pit bulls, manifested in various ways, including their support of breed-specific legislation. So that represents just some of PETA's operations and policies under the leadership of Ingrid Newkirk. Talk, if you could, about how you sorted out expressing your feelings about those policies and about Newkirk herself in writing this book.
Sure. I first started writing about PETA's shelter, I think, back in about 2013 or so. And I think, like a lot of people who love animals, I had grown up, you know, not really knowing what PETA was and what they did. I knew that they supported animal rights. I didn't really know much beyond that. And then in about 2013, I remember coming across their shelter statistics, which, like you said, are pretty dire. I mean, they kill a lot of animals at their one animal shelter in Norfolk, Virginia. And I remember at the time, I don't remember if I had yet been named animal welfare editor at the Huffington Post or if I was just acting as animal welfare editor at the time, which I did for quite a while before I got that job title. But I remember reaching out to them and asking, can you explain, you know, what's going on here? And then saying, well, we think that this is the kindest thing to do, basically. We are euthanizing animals who are old, who are sick, who are unadoptable in some way, and we think that this is the right thing to do. And I was surprised. I tried to make sense of it. I kept asking them for more information, and they just kept giving me that tagline. And by that point, I was getting pretty involved with other animal sheltering, and I had gotten, you know, I would say now I know more than I did then, but at the time I was speaking with a lot of people who were at the, I guess you would call it the more progressive side of the animal sheltering movement, and who were adopting out dogs who are old, dogs who are sick, you know, the feral cats, you know, they were finding ways to keep them alive instead of killing them like they were doing at PETA's shelter. And so I came back to them and I said, well, you know, are you working with rescue groups? Are you finding rescue groups who might be able to find permanent foster homes, hospice homes for your sick dogs? And they just came back and said, this is the kind of thing to do. Wow. And I, you know, I remember the more questions I asked them, the more I just became rather furious, actually, that this was their attitude toward animals who had investments in their own lives, who had every right to try to live out their lives, at least as I saw it. And then I found out other things that PETA was doing, like going to communities and trying to convince lawmakers to, instead of engaging in trap, neuter, release — your listeners probably all know what that is — that's where community cats, outdoor cats, are given vaccinations and are spayed and neutered and then are returned to the places where they came from, instead of killing them. Those are basically two cat management plans. You can either trap and kill, which is what PETA was advocating, or you can trap, neuter, release, which is what almost everybody else is advocating is the more humane option.
Yeah.
You know, and they joined up with this group of pit bull haters. I mean, there's really no other way to put it. This group of pit bull haters that want to eradicate pit bulls. And PETA says they don't want to eradicate pit bulls. They just support all of this legislation and policy that would effectively eradicate pit bulls. But it was this very troubling — it was the set of very troubling things.
So really, especially as you learn more, either as acting animal welfare editor at Huffington Post or officially as animal welfare editor at Huffington Post, the more you got into the shelter world and learned more, it sounds like the more clear it was to you that the PETA position was sort of an outlier.
Yeah, very much so. Very much an outlier. Yeah.
And for an organization that purports to be very concerned about animals and their welfare and their lives and safety and other things, it seemed inconsistent, I guess.
It did. And I should preface this by saying they are on the right side of many other issues.
Right.
I mean, they support spay and neuter programs. They support, you know, they go around and give out dog houses to people who can't bring their dogs inside for whatever reason. And especially on farm animal issues and lab testing issues. I mean, they're on the right side of a lot of things,
sure,
but they're very much outside of the norm. And as far as, you know, now I can say I think they're wrong on a lot of these other companion animal issues.
So we're going to come back to in a moment to how that figures into Your Robot Dog Will Die. Again, we're speaking with Erin Greenwood and about her new book, which is indeed Your Robot Dog Will Die. And again, it just came out yesterday, and we're going to take a call, and then we're going to talk more about how the PETA discussion figures into the book. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Erin Greenwood.
Yes, it's great to have a animal welfare journalist on. One thing that really troubles me about almost all media coverage of animals is that unless it's one of those look at the cute animal that got saved by somebody, pet focused, or we're trying to rescue beached whales, a lot of media, and I'm including the Tampa Bay Times in this, they promote animal cruelty, hunting, fishing, especially wherever there's an economic interest in harming animals, barbecue, contests, fishing, hunting licenses. It's just an epidemic that the society's speciesism, the belief that humans have a right to do whatever they want to all other species, that is just totally reflected and amplified in the media, especially in the culinary type of coverage on NPR. It's always eat the animals. Who cares about their welfare? And I'm wondering if you see the same cheerleading for ritualistic and routinized cultural animal abuse that I'm seeing in the mainstream media on a regular basis.
All right, thank you for your call. Erin?
Yeah, I think what you're saying is exactly correct in a lot of ways. You know, I was at a conference a couple of years ago where there was a woman from a nonprofit that is advocating for shelters and rescue groups only to serve plant-based food at their own events because of there is this kind of gross tension between trying to save some animals and killing others at the same time, you know. And you know, I saw the other day an event notice for a crawfish boil for a no-kill animal shelter, and it just struck me as being, you know, exactly as you're saying, that it's there's this book that I think you might be interested in called Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat by the academic Hal Herzog. But it sort of gets into how it is that we have these culturally different attitudes towards some species than we do toward others. But I like to think that there's some progress even on this front. I mean, I wrote a story about this a couple of years ago for Best Friends Animal Society's magazine. I don't know that you can find it online, but I think the concept will ring true to you, that, you know, we now have these animal ambassadors like Esther the Wonder Pig, who, you know, helps people see pigs as being more like dogs than like the other animals who you might not consider as beings instead of as products. And that hopefully bit by bit, you know, people will expand their kind of their moral feelings toward more and more species and start treating them better as well. I think technology is in that favor, too. I mean, we're getting more and more alternatives to meat, you know, the lab-grown meats, the other sorts of meats, and hopefully those will encourage more people who now do take part in barbecue to switch over to less harmful methods. But you're absolutely right that we have different attitudes toward different animals, and it strikes, I think, people like you and me as being a little odd that people care so much about this one and not the other.
Right. Well, and that's sort of addressed in Your Robot Dog Will Die in a way, right? That sort of issue. And just, I want to add one other thing, just because what the caller was pointing out, I mean, even, and as you've noted too, Aaron, even in animal organization events, like years and years ago, over on my side of the state, I was asked to host an event. It was a greyhound related event, let's say. And everything that was served was this big plate of meat and gravy and whatever. And I thought, really? And then more recently, I thought, okay, over time, I hope at least that they've kind of like fixed that. But just recently, I did a big show with a dog-related, let's say, organization. And they were going to have a big graduation kind of event ceremony. And they invited me to it, which was very nice, except it was going to be held at SeaWorld, which I thought, really? So anyway, I think on the one hand, we're making progress, because I'd like to believe that the greyhound thing of several years ago probably wouldn't serve that kind of same meal at their event. I was pretty shocked, frankly, by these folks holding an important event to them at SeaWorld with everything we've learned in recent years about SeaWorld. So anyways, we do have some more callers. Let me at least just briefly get back. Callers, don't go away. I'm going to get right to you. But I just want to finish kind of this thought a little bit about the PETA thing that we were discussing, and sort of how, in allegory form, at least is how I put it, the PETA situation runs through your book. One of the key characters is sort of a Ingrid counterpart, I guess you could safely say. And I guess this was sort of some of the way the storyline and this character was sort of dealing with some of the stuff we were just talking about before the caller called in and sort of expanded that discussion a little bit. Was there an idea of just saying, well, I have to deal, given the nature of this book and the way it's taking form, I have to sort of deal with the very issues you just described about the outlier that PETA is? Was that kind of like how they ended up in some form, in some disguise, thinly disguised form, in the book?
Well, just to be clear, the community in Dog Island is not, you know, it's very different from PETA.
Right.
The idea for it might have been sparked by reporting on PETA, but it's not PETA.
Okay, right, yeah. right. Well, that's true. Yeah. But I guess Dorothy, at least, is seems similar in some ways to Ingrid Newkirk, the leader of PETA.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess what was important to me was this, that in trying to make sense of some of these ideas that didn't make any sense to me, which is, you know, how do you love animals but kill all of these animals and say that you're doing it for their good? I felt that it was very important to sort of try to examine it in good faith, I guess, and try to have characters who thought that they really were doing the right thing, and just see what that looked like, and not be cynical and not be facile, you know, but to take them seriously and see, you know, what are they right about? What are they wrong about? You know, what does this look like when it turns into reality. You know, what if you have a whole community of people who are living by these rules that, you know, are supposed to be kind, but are hard to take it. I'm being too abstract, aren't I?
No, because, I mean, one of the things that I thought was interesting about it is that because it's a novel, it's fiction, yeah. Did it for you as you were starting to shape the book and the ideas for the book, was it sort of like, well, here's another way to kind of address a situation that has perplexed, if not bothered me over the years, but not in a journalistic form, but in a literary fictional form?
Yeah, I think that's just right. And you know, how do people come to find themselves in this community doing things that probably if they step back and look at them, they would find wrong, you know, but they're in the middle of it and it seems right because this is the life that they're living. This is the world that they live in, and it's hard. I mean, I think that expands beyond animal welfare. I mean, I think that expands to all sorts of cultural norms that people partake in. You know, just like you're saying, I mean, I guess this is back to animal welfare, but just like the previous caller was saying, you know, how is it that you love animals and then hold a pig roast to honor them? You know, there's a lot of cultural norms and a lot of things that you just do because that's how you do it. And, you know, what does it look like when you take a step back from that?
Exactly. Okay, so we're going to get at least one of our callers involved. I just want to let folks know again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Erin Greenwood. We're discussing her new novel, Your Robot Dog Will Die, which came out yesterday. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. And if you'd like to see this conversation, we are streaming now on Facebook Live via my personal page. Just go to Duncan Strauss on Facebook, and you can see Erin and I chatting here in the WMNF studio. So let's take another caller. Hi, you're on on Talking Animals with Erin Greenwood.
This is Terry in Clearwater.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes, you know, I agree with her on the cruelty to animals and everything or another else, but there are a lot of angles on this. And, you know, just our beef and pork industry alone does more to contribute to man-made climate change than every rolling vehicle on the road. Not to mention the horrendous waste of water strictly to feed these animals so that they can excrete more methane into our atmosphere. I mean, there are a lot of negatives about these factory farms and the way animals are treated. It's horrific. And that every angle that can possibly be used should be used to reduce the consumption of animals. That's pretty well all I got to say.
Okay, well, thank you for your call. Erin, anything you'd like to respond to?
Yeah, I'd like to say a couple of things. One is, actually, I'm glad that you brought this up for a number of reasons. One is another aspect of the book, which I guess is a very complicated book. I hadn't even gotten into this aspect of it, but it takes place in a world with climate change where sea level has changed things and there's drought. And I think you're exactly right that factory farming is contributing to this in real life right now. And there's a scene in the book that takes place at a flooded farm. But yeah, I have said a lot of times, and I think you are exactly right, that in the not too distant future from now, probably a decade from now, we're going to look back at how we treated farmed animals and just... We will be shocked that we allowed that to happen.
For sure. Well, here's a little bit simpler question to answer that's come in from one of our emailers. Is Your Robot Dog Will Die available in Kindle format?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
There we go. Yay.
And audiobook.
Okay. And again, as of yesterday, pretty much available anywhere else you get your books in any form, brick and mortar stores, online stores, etc., and then as well as Kindle and the whole shebang.
And if you go audiobooks. To the Barnes & Noble in St. Pete, there's one signed copy there right now. My husband and I went there last night.
Oh,
and
wow.
I signed a copy that the bookstore manager said it was okay to do. I was just so giddy seeing it there.
Oh, that's great. So now there'll be a stampede for that one copy. But may the best person get there first. Anyway, sort of this ties back in some ways to something we've touched on and that our first caller raised is, But one notable aspect of Your Robot Dog Will Die deals with the way residents of Dog Island choose to eat. And in contrast, there's the way those elsewhere eat, particularly those involved with a farm sanctuary, let's say, that comes up later in the book. Can you share a little bit more of your thinking in fashioning those elements of the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So the the people who live in Dog Island are, they eat plant-based food. They're vegans. And our main character, Nano, it's just, again, it's just what she's grown up with. Her dad is actually the head of food at Dog Island. So, you know, she's the guinea pig for a lot of the new foods that he's taking in. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good. But, you know, this is the world that she knows. And when she has to leave Dog Island for a little bit, she discovers other ways of doing things. And one of them is I don't want to give too much away because I hope it's going to be a fun surprise for people when they get to this other place. But she has to sort of reckon with and learn about other ways of thinking about living with animals, you know, that some people consume animals and some of them do it in ways that seem horrific to her and some of them do it in ways that start seeming less horrific to her. And it you know, it's just one of the things that she comes across that makes her kind of rethink what it is that she's taking for granted and what she knows.
Like I said earlier, I mean, there's a lot to this. Not that there isn't to other YA novels. Not that I've read all the YA novels out there, but it does seem like there's some real depth and some serious issues that are woven into here. Something that's a bit lighter that I was interested in is smoking weed is a fairly prominent part of the action in this book. So how come?
The truth is, I don't actually smoke pot myself right mm-hmm. now, but as a teenager, sorry, Mom.
Uh-oh, true confessions?
As a teenager, it was around a fair amount, and it seemed like writing about teenagers without having some kind of experimentation, without having something in their lives that was changing their brains, you know, was dishonest. And I thought if I'm going to have teenagers and make them seem real, then this has to be a part of their lives. You know, they have to be experimenting with something. But then there are adult characters who partake a little bit as well.
Sure.
And I didn't see any reason to be, I don't know, nun-like about it when that's not how life is.
Right. Okay, cool. All right, let's take another caller. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Erin Greenwood.
Hi, is that me?
Yeah, sure. Please go ahead if you have a question or comment for Erin.
Hi, I do. Thanks for taking the call. I look forward to reading the book. I actually am interested in the topic of TNVR and also some of the things you were discussing. And I, as someone who's done TNVR and who's taken dogs in literally off the street, have a bit of a different opinion as far as necessarily being able to say what's right and what's wrong. I think there are some gray areas. For example, I've trapped over 30 cats literally on my street. Where I live in South St. Petersburg, and after doing this, I really question whether or not it's the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. I don't think there's a right or wrong in it, because it's a pretty horrific life for the cats that get returned to the street. The cats that I trapped between two houses on my street were passing scabies and manes back and forth from each other. The ones that were more tame literally disappeared, and we guessed that that's because there are people who come along and they take cats and they take them and use them in dog fighting. So you see what I mean? There's not necessarily a right or wrong in that. And then as far as the dog population goes, I literally am dog poor. I've taken two dogs off the street in South St. Pete and have been unable to rehome them. Have been unable to turn them over to non-kill shelters because they're full. So I guess as far as the PETA question goes about what's the best for certain dogs, you know, I think there's just a real gray area there. And I appreciate there being a chance to even talk about this somewhere out there. But I just wanted to add that to the conversation.
Great. Well, I'm glad you did. Thanks so much for your call. Any response, Erin, you'd like
to
offer?
Well, first of all, thank you for helping all these animals. I mean, it's people, I really admire the people who are doing this, and thank you for taking care of all these animals. The other thing that I would say is just, you know, sometimes we don't have perfect options. Sometimes we don't have a comfortable no-kill shelter there for every cat at this point, and so you're dealing with trade-offs. And the trade-off is, you know, are you going to return a cat to an outdoor colony where they have the chance to live and where the evidence shows that, in general, this is a good option for cats, or are you going to bring them and have them euthanized where they're, you know, where, and you have to decide what is the better option as far as the evidence goes, as far as your judgment about what constitutes a good life or a good death goes. I think TNR or TMVR is the better option in most circumstances. But if you have a sick cat, you know, a sick cat is not going to do well outside. So a sick cat has to be brought in for medical treatment somewhere, hopefully brought inside somewhere safe. Hopefully there's somewhere safe for them to go. But I think you're also pointing to the need for more safe shelters that are open for animals who really do need care and are not going to do well out on the street.
And I will say that in a few minutes, although it'll be a brief conversation when we speak with Amber Simpson about the annual Tampa Vegan Bake Sale, the proceeds from that go to helping feral and community cats, often with TNR-related programs and stuff. So we'll touch on that at least briefly with Amber in a bit. I'm afraid we're in our final few minutes here, Aaron, but let me ask you, if author's intent matches up pretty well with reader's understanding, what are two or three important things you'd like readers to take away from Your Robot Dog Will Die?
Well, two or three things. The main thing is I really want people to be entertained and moved. I mean, that's the first thing. It's a story. We've been talking a lot about the themes and the issues behind the story. But, you know, at its base, it's a tale. And I hope it's a fast-moving tale. And I hope it's a gripping tale that people will find themselves drawn in by. But then my next goal, and this is probably the primary thing, this is what... You know, this is my intent as a journalist as well. I guess I'm an advocacy journalist. I want people to be inspired to go help animals like you're doing, like the last caller is doing, you know, to go out and go do good things for animals. I mean, if people start tweeting me pictures of dogs that they're fostering or adopting after reading my book, I will be so ridiculously thrilled by it. You know, if people tell me that they've decided to reduce the amount of meat that they're eating after reading my book, I will be very, very happy about that. You know, I want people to be entertained, and I want them to be better to animals.
And I will say, on going in order, point number one, it's very brisk, fast-paced book. It's fun to read, and it zooms along. And again, if you have any interest in animals or animal welfare, even more so. But even if you don't, per se, it's still a really great, entertaining, and I used the word originally, and so I'll steal it back from you, gripping book. It's just one of those that's kind of hard to put down. So for me, it certainly succeeds on that level. And then with those animal themes and with the idea of what sorts of things are really being highlighted in the book, I would hope that it would inspire people to help animals. Some already are. Some maybe will do it more. Some will maybe do it in a slightly different way after reading the book. And I think people will be sending you pictures, I'm sure, of dogs that they've adopted or helped, or other animals too, which they already do. And I should let people know that aren't otherwise familiar, Aaron is spelled A-R-I-N, and if you look, and it's Greenwood is her last name. So you look on Facebook, you'll almost always see a bunch of great pictures of, I mean, her stories are often posted there, of course. You'll see a bunch of people posting pictures of dogs or stories about dogs, including tear-jerking stories either that she writes or that are related to her about people like adopting senior dogs or dogs even that are ill, and people just kind of giving them a cool final life. Anyway, so it's definitely worth checking out on all kinds of levels. So almost out of time, but anything we should just touch on as far as your day job, which I gather from a semi-cryptic Facebook post may have shifted a little bit, at least temporarily. So I don't know if you can say what you're doing or what you normally do, but just in our last moment or two, if you want to touch on any of those things, feel free.
It's still a little bit cryptic. I'll let you know as soon as I can.
Okay.
Yeah, I traditionally have been an animal welfare writer, just writing a lot of stories about people. I like to think of them as stories that show the best of what people can do for animals. So animals who have gone through hard stuff, and then we see their lives turned around by good people, and hopefully that provides a model for other people then to go out and do good too.
All right, cool. So again, you can find her work at the Today Show website, periodically in the Washington Post, frequently on the Dodo, and are those kind of the main, am I leaving the main outlet out, or that?
Yeah, those are the big ones.
Yeah, okay, cool. So, and I guess the final question, circling back to mainly talking today about the book, Your Robot Dog Will Die. Have you started a new book?
I have.
Okay,
I have,
cool.
Yeah.
Any sneak
sure.
Previews? Or
yeah,
any?
Yeah. It's you know, it's very related to what you were just talking about. It's about a couple who adopts a dying elderly pit bull.
Mm.
Yeah, and a couple who had been falling apart and then take this dog into their homes, and she kind of turns their lives around.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, well, Can't wait to read that baby, and it's great that you're already, sounds like knee-deep, or at least ankle-deep into
toe
it.
Toe-deep.
Toe-deep. Okay, yeah. Well, some depth.
Hey, this book just came out.
That's right. No, I know. That's what I mean. That's why I'm so impressed that you're already writing away, and you can tell me the story already, or at least the basic premise. So, again, this has been Aaron Greenwood. The new book is Your Robot Dog Will Die, as we've touched on. Anywhere that you get your books, brick and mortar, online, audiobooks, elsewhere, Kindle, etc., all those places have Your Robot Dog Will Die. And again, I really, really enjoyed the book and have said so publicly and online, and happy to say so again here. So, Aaron, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to hear a little announcement shortly about something important coming up. But in a few minutes, I'll speak with Amber Simpson about the 8th annual Tampa Vegan Bake Sale happening this Saturday, April 21st at Mojo Books and Records. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner after we hear this important message.
Hi, this is Drew Hunter.
And Christina Costa.
With a WMNF community announcement.
Walk Bike Tampa and local bike groups invite you to join the Ride of Silence on Wednesday, May 16th.
The ride, set during National Bike Month, aims to raise awareness that cyclists have a right to travel on public roadways.
We'll meet at Curtis Hickson Waterfront Park, ride slowly, wear helmets, and follow the rules of the road.
We'll remain silent to honor the lives of cyclists who have been killed or injured on our roads.
Visit walkbiketampa.org for details.
I really am a boring person when I'm home. I just hang out at the house. I hang out with my cat. I got a cat named Jessica. Thank you. I'm a cat person. Are there any other cat people out there? Yeah, got some cat people here. Nice. I'm guessing the rest of you are dog people. Is that what it is? Yeah. I'm not anti-dog. Yeah. Every time I tell someone I'm a cat person, I'm like, what does that mean? You don't like dogs? No, that's not what that means. It just means I like other people's dogs. I like dogs. I just like them over there, and I'll play with them, but then go back over there. I don't like that kind of energy in my house. You know what I mean? That annoying dog, best friend in your face all the time energy. Just like, yeah. I love you. You're home. Where have you been? It creeps me out. I don't care for that. I don't like that at all. Just in your face. Like, you want to go out? There's a tree. I know this tree. You want to hang out at this tree? What if I just keep breathing into your face? Ugh. All the time? No, thank you. That's why I like cats. Cats are more like, hey, what are you up to? Never mind. I just remembered I don't care. I'll be in the kitchen. I'll see you later. I like that. I don't need a best friend at the house. I just need like an apathetic roommate that sometimes wants to hang out.
That was Zoltan Kazas with a piece I've called Cats Part 1, an excerpt from a much longer piece he did for Dry Bar Comedy. Okay, on to Amber Simpson to hear about this year's edition of the Tampa Vegan Bake Sale. This is Amber Simpson back on Talking Animals. Good morning, Amber.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Thank you.
So remind me, this is the 8th annual, so remind me what prompted the very first vegan bake sale.
Well, the very first vegan bake sale was actually the idea of Mojo Books and Music, or Books and Records. This is in conjunction with the Worldwide Record Store Day, and so they have a big event where they have live bands and limited edition records and whatnot. Requested to have a vegan bake sale because they're animal lovers and they just really wanted to raise some money for the animals. So we jumped right on it, and this is our 8th year.
Great. So needless to say then, from the very beginning, it was held at Mojo.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. All 8 years we've been at Mojo.
Nice. So as we try to, when we've had these kind of conversations in the past, I'd love for you to highlight two or three baked goods offerings that are either old faves from past bake sales or that maybe you're introducing new this time that you think should get some extra attention. Whatever you think.
Okay. Well, this year we've actually been blessed by getting some donations from some great vegan restaurants in the Tampa Bay area. So we have International Vegan Kitchen that are donating some of their cakes. We have Pharmacy Vegan Kitchen and Bakery that have some of their yummy gluten-free vegan options.
Wow.
We have Donut Therapy, which has really great donuts. And a new company, We Vegan Eats, that has great cookies. So this year, we're really looking forward to highlighting some of the donations that we've gotten from some of these great local vegan businesses. But, of course, as usual, last year a big hit was our mini pizzas, and those are going to be back this year, as well as cupcakes and cinnamon rolls and cookies and all the other favorites that everyone has.
Yeah, well, once again, you're making me super hungry. But and I think, even though it's not really a baked good per se, as I recall, now that you mention it, the pizzas seem to be like a super big fave, right?
Yes, everybody loves pizza, and vegans are no different. So you hear the word vegan pizza, and, you know, people come out like zombies. So we're I'm the one who actually makes those, and I will at least have 60 of them, but they will go extremely fast.
Right. So if we said this already, I meant to, but I don't know if we did. So we did say that it's happening this Saturday, and we did, of course, say that it's happening at Mojo Books and Records. But did we say that the time?
It'll be from 8 to 4.
Okay.
If we have things left at 4, we will stay later, but that's just the general time frame. Of course, the earlier the better, because people are lined up outside the door like at 7 o'clock in the morning to get into the store for their limited edition records.
Right. So some are there, of course, for the limited edition records. Some are there for the pizzas and some of the other stuff.
Yes.
It's like, hey, you snooze, you lose, man. Those will be sold out in no time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So people are already always gathered around our table before we're even set up. So definitely first thing in the morning is the best way to get what you're looking for. As the day moves on, you know, we run out pretty fast.
This ties into something that one of our callers, when we were speaking earlier with Aaron Greenwood, noted. But can you talk a little bit about where some of the proceeds from the vegan bake sale go to in terms of helping feral community cats, et cetera?
Yes. So our main focus is the feral cats. The community cats in the Tampa Bay area, our big focus is TNR, the Trap, Neuter, Return program, for the cats that don't have a home to go to. At least we get them fixed, vaccinated, and they go back to where they live without reproducing and spreading diseases. And also, when you do that, you find tons of kittens, and of course, it's kitten season. They all need to be vaccinated, spayed, neutered themselves, and put up for adoption. And then, of course, we also have just people in the community that might not be able to afford the surgeries, and we want to offer that to them. So basically, it's spay and neuter is our biggest platform to what we pay for, and some of the money also goes to emergencies, emergency vet care, and other supplies that it takes to do this. But we support every local rescue group in the community. We love all of them. Humane Society, Animal Coalition of Tampa, our great low-cost spay-neuter clinics, and every local rescue group that you can think of out there, we are glad to have them in our area. We're very lucky, and we just want to raise as much money to spread around as possible to get as many cats taken care of and off the street, spay-neutered, and reducing the population.
So if I have this right, if you go over to Mojo Books and Records on Saturday, you can get whatever cool records or books that they have, especially the Record Day special offerings. You can get stuff from the bake sale. And by doing so, at least the bake sale side of things, you can support community and feral cats, all kinds of areas that need our help and need either some TNR or something else to help kind of make their lives better. So it's a pretty good way to spend part of your day on Saturday.
Yes, it's a good day. Everyone, every age, even children, everyone loves to come out, eat a bunch of vegan food, you know, bring some to-go containers if you want to take something home with you. We have plates and bags and stuff like that as well. And, you know, eat a donut while you go shopping for your records.
There you go.
What could be better?
That's great. Okay, Amber, well, thanks again for filling us in. Again, that's this Saturday, the 21st at Mojo Books and Records from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. or maybe a little bit longer if there's stuff left, which is unlikely. So thanks again for joining us and all your great work.
Yeah, and you can see us on Facebook at Tampa Vegan Bake Sale. And we'll post the latest. If you have any questions, we'll try to answer it through there. If anyone is, you know, running late and wants to see if anything's left, Tampa Vegan Bake Sale on Facebook.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Amber.
Thank you. Bye.
So coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Loroy and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott and the Old Souls edition of It's the Music. And I'm Duncan Strauss. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. I invite you to join me next week when my guest will be Nicole Forsythe, CEO of Red Rover, a national organization that is focused on bringing animals out of crisis and seeking to strengthen the human-animal bond through emergency sheltering, disaster relief services, financial assistance, and humane education. So, all kinds of stuff about social media and archives and podcasts and everything can all be found at talkinganimals.net. Thanks so much. It's Talking Animals on WNF 10.